Welcome to this very exciting edition of Pain. we share your pain. You share our pain. Okay. We're going to have a public hearing today. We're not going to take action. There are a couple of amendments which we'll talk about. We will have a follow-up public hearing and at some point hopefully a work session and hopefully pass this bill out. This bill has a colorful history. This is the third session that it was introduced, the first session in 03. It didn't get traction. The second session in 05, I killed it. Literally. Because I felt it had some problems, sideboards, security, law enforcement involvement, protection of physicians, protection of pharmacists, and so on, protection of clients. We have worked very hard, and I have been engaged during the interim with the workings of this bill. I did attend a conference recently where there was a full day devoted to the discussion of this bill. It was a national conference, and there were people from a variety of states. I got a sense of what other states were doing. And, in fact, the speaker that we have in a moment was at that conference, and we invited her to come to Oregon. She has a great background, and she will introduce herself in just a moment. So I think that this is going to be an interesting bill to hear, and we have plenty of testimony, and we will carry it over as well. So with that, Paige Clark, would you please? Okay, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 34. Would you like to do a brief overview of Senate Bill 34?
Senate Bill 34 requires the State Board of Pharmacy to establish an electronic database for information reported by pharmacies regarding dispensing of certain controlled substances. It creates the Electronic Prescription Drug Database Advisory Commission. Declares an emergency effective on patents.
Okay, Dana Droz and Kathy Hahn. Okay, Paige, would you like to start off, please?
Thank you, Chair Morissette and Vice Chair Cruz and committee members. My name is Paige Clark. I'm the staff pharmacist, consultant pharmacist for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. My role is to serve as a resource and liaison to entities in the state, including other agencies, the legislature, and other interested parties, as well as to provide research and program support to the board. I've been a practicing pharmacist for over 20 years, and upon joining the board staff in March, was one of the first people to begin receiving phone calls from a variety of practitioners that were asking for help with this issue. The purpose of Senate Bill 34 is to require the Board of Pharmacy to collect dispensing data from pharmacies to create a prescription drug monitoring program for Oregon. The Oregon Board of Pharmacy has been awarded a $350,000 grant for the purposes of developing and establishing such a database, which becomes a tool for prescribers to help them determine if a patient is seeing multiple doctors and pharmacies to seek prescription drugs for abuse or diversion to our streets. Currently, there is no mechanism by which a prescriber can determine if a person is in fact seeing multiple prescribers and pharmacies to seek controlled substance prescription drugs. Legislative action is required to compel the Board of Pharmacy to collect data from pharmacies. Once the database is developed, there's an additional augmentation grant of $400,000 that the board may apply for that will augment the program to provide an early intervention drug treatment component to the program. That would put us at potential grant funding of about $750,000. States currently running such programs have found this approach to be successful in their efforts to get a handle on prescription drug abuse. The question of impact on prescribing will be addressed in a few moments by various practitioners who can speak to the ramifications of not having such a program in place for prescribers and patients here in our state. Additionally, the chair of the Oregon Pain Commission has comments of support to make with regard to Senate Bill 34. The chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse as well has comments to make in favor of this legislation. And a representative from the Oregon Methamphetamine Task Force will speak in favor of this bill as well. previous discussions with the ACLU would probably indicate that they would remain opposed to this legislation on the basis they oppose the development of any databases, regardless of purpose or merit, and their concerns over security and privacy of the data, and that somehow this may interfere with the patient-physician relationship. Those issues will probably be discussed effectively today. This program runs successfully in many states and has had neither security nor misuse issues. Indeed, Oregon is one of the remaining 17 states in the nation without such a program in place. Of those 17, 11 are currently seeking legislative enactment. 33 states have been running or are implementing or are augmenting their programs currently. The map in your attachment that I gave you, which is on the back side of item number 2, will serve as a resource for you and a visual as to those states. Oregon is, in fact, surrounded by states that are running, augmenting, or developing these programs, making Oregon a target for prescription controlled substance drug diversion rings. Not all prescriptions are reported into this database. Only controlled substances, which are scheduled 2, 3, or 4 controlled substances, are reported. These are the substances that are most commonly sought by those seeking to abuse prescription drugs. The second handout in your packet represents a collaborative effort by Oregon's Department of Human Services, Addiction and Alcohol Department, and programs that shows the rapidly rising numbers associated with prescription drug abuse in Oregon. This supports the need for such a tool to be available for prescribers here in our state. Several of the senators that had served on the interim committee were interested in seeing such information if we could find that for them. Since this bill was heard and adopted as a committee-sponsored bill by the Senate Interim Healthcare Committee in September, the language has been further studied and carefully reviewed by experts from around the nation who have offered additional ideas for minor language amendments, which are included in the several of the pieces in front of you. And I can actually go through the DASH amendments very briefly to update you on them. DASH 1 on page 2 of the printed bill, on line 20, after the authorized, it will insert the drug-related clause, and that would further tighten this language so that any investigations of this language would be involved around drug-related investigations only. And secondly, to bring to your attention, after line 42, an insert is noted here, and you see that in front of you, and this is an immunity clause for prescribers and for pharmacists who choose maybe not to access the database. And that was brought forth by a recommendation for the Oregon Medical Association, which has been included. There's a third amendment that I wonder, let's see, I think I have it in front of me here. The DASH 2 amendment on page 3 of the printed bill, line 11, delete 13 and insert 14. In line 25, after the semicolon, add Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. That's a friendly amendment. We certainly welcome that. They would like to be added to the permanent commission that has been put into place for this language. Today we have been very fortunate to bring you.
Excuse me for just a minute. Is the DASH? Did you mention DASH 3s? Did you mention?
I'm sorry, just a DASH 1 and a DASH 2.
Okay.
There were two items on DASH 1.
We will go ahead and talk about the DASH 3s.
Okay.
Which, Claudia, would you come up here, please, and slide in for just a minute? We do have all the amendments in hand. I wasn't sure we would have the DASH 3s, but if you just very briefly get this on the record, and then we will adopt these at some other time, but just to let people know.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Claudia Black, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Department of Corrections. The OMA has testimony, written testimony that we're presenting today, but in addition to that, we're offering the DASH 3 amendments. In conversations with our physicians, We felt that physicians were not the appropriate source of revenue to continue the prescription database after the grant funds run out, and we talked to the Board of Pharmacy a little bit about that, and they thought perhaps assessing a fee for physicians and pharmacists might be something that they would like to look at. The Oregon Medical Association discussed this and felt very strongly that physicians were not the appropriate source of revenue. As I said, probably between 5% and 10% of physicians would even be using the system. So we're respectfully submitting the Dash 3s for consideration.
So is the Department of Corrections okay with this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure. I don't represent them any longer.
Oh, well, you did mention this. For the record, you no longer...
Right, for the record.
Sorry about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I no longer represent public health either.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Thank you.
What?
Caught me a little off guard. I'll go ahead and continue if that works for you. Today we've been able to bring you one of the leading experts in the nation on prescription drug databases, Dana Droz, seated to my far right, who will be speaking to you in a few moments and is available to answer your questions as well. Upon reviewing comments from the Senate Interim Healthcare Committee and holding yet another stakeholder meeting, input led us to craft further security measures and review the usage guidelines and establishment of, again, a permanent commission that is an advisory commission to advise the Board of Pharmacy in the long-term use of the program. It's important to note that this program does not create any new data. All of this dispensing data is available and accessible in individual pharmacies to various entities and regulatory bodies at the pharmacy level through their normal channels currently. It is not, however, in a readily usable or accessible form for prescribers. This bill gathers and formats this information into a usable form for prescribers. It establishes a tool for pharmacies and prescribers that is HIPAA-compliant, secure, and accurate. In fact, by establishing this database, the parameters for access are increased. Law enforcement will need a court order rather than simply a subpoena to access data. Regulatory bodies will need to present documentation of an ongoing investigation of a specific individual to access data. And prescribers and pharmacies will be credentialed prior to being granted a request for patient's data. This program does not grant access to this information to anyone who does not currently have access to it. Section 4, number 4, spells out those areas of access. Before I conclude and we proceed, perhaps we can take just a moment to review the documents in your packet so I can tell you what's there. And finally, I've been asked to present just a couple of comments from several practitioners that were not able to be with us today. You have copies of those, so I won't belabor a lot of that time, but I'd like to go through a couple of them. Dr. Jenny Soike. She's your first letter in front of you. And she says, I'm writing in support of the statewide pharmacy database for controlled substances. I've been an emergency room physician in this state for 10 years, the last 8 in Roseburg. Currently, I'm the medical director of Lane County Adult Corrections Health Services Department. And I will let you read that on your own. But she says, both legality and safety of patients and the public are issues when some patients are getting multiple prescriptions from multiple physicians, including emergency departments. I'll direct your attention to the second letter, which is from Corvallis Family Medicine. Instead of being a specialty area practice like Dr. Soike, they are a family medicine practice. And they say, we are writing to you in support of Senate Bill 34, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Bill. Corvallis Family Medicine is an independent family practice group consisting of 5 physicians and 2 nurse practitioners in Corvallis, Oregon. Honesty, trust, and open communications are key components of the physician-patient relationship. Unfortunately, being trusting can make physicians vulnerable to patients who are seeking to divert, sell, or abuse controlled substance medications by doctor shopping and by pharmacy shopping. And the next letter is from Dr. Peter Kosick, who states, I am a board-certified pain management physician in Eugene. I'll let you go through his letter on your own. He's an OMA delegate and a member of the Oregon Pain Commission. A couple of his comments.
Many arguments against this monitoring program suggest that there's a conflict between having accurate information on an individual's prescriptions for narcotic analgesics and the ability of a physician to use these medications to treat pain. They imply that keeping this information secret makes it easier for physicians to prescribe these analgesics in the treatment of pain. The opposite is true. I am far more willing to prescribe analgesics when I have full information on other analgesics the patient has access to. And finally, the final letter in your packet. Actually, there are two more in your packet. Dear Senator Morissette, and he went on, this is from Dr. Edward Pietmeyer, who is also in family practice. He says, at this time, it is difficult, if not impossible, for our physicians to comprehensively review a new or an existing patient's utilization of pain medications over time. There is no ability for our physicians to make informed decisions regarding the need for a transition to long-acting pain medications because increasing the use of short-acting medications is not meeting their needs. There is no ability to coordinate pain management plans between treating physicians because of lack of information. And I'll just refer you to your packet. There's information here not only from the state of Oregon. The first sheet, sort of a simple 20-second overview of the bill, if you will. Then information from the state of Oregon and national data as well. And then some increasingly more complex pieces as you go through that perhaps staff or yourself would be interested in. In conclusion to my introduction of this language, let me express my thanks to Senator Morissette and the committee for taking the time to study and hear this language, bringing Oregon up to the level of the majority of U.S. states who have such programs in place will serve the citizens of Oregon well. Thank you, Chair Morissette.
Kathy Hahn.
Don't we want Dana to go next?
Okay. Dana, would you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Chair Morissette. My name is Dana Droz, and I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to be here and speak with you and the other members of the committee today. I currently serve as the Prescription Monitoring Administrator for the Ohio State Board of Pharmacy. I've been in this position a little over a year. Prior to that, I ran the Kentucky Prescription Monitoring Program since its inception in 1998. Further in my background, I am a pharmacist. I have experience in retail, community pharmacy, hospital pharmacy, and long-term care pharmacy. I've also worked while at my earliest days in state government as an investigator for the Drug Control Unit, which was similar to the state equivalent of FDA and DEA, and we investigated the use of and misuse of prescription drugs. So I'm well versed in these issues, and I've been interested in looking at the prescription monitoring programs around the country for about the last 15 years. It's been very interesting to see the changes and the things that have happened in the last 2 years as many more states have developed these programs. What I'd like to do today is give you a little bit of overview about prescription monitoring programs in general, some specifics about how they work, some things they do, some things they don't do. If you have questions at any point, I'll be happy to stop and answer your questions. A prescription monitoring program basically collects prescription data from pharmacies that dispense these drugs. It then disseminates the prescription data to those entities that are allowed by the state statute. This is patient-specific data, which is disseminated for the purpose of treatment. And then some state laws allow de-identified data to be used for other purposes, such as education of health care providers and the public, as well as research. And some states have other things in their laws. It varies pretty widely from state to state, but all of the programs follow a lot of the same general format. The goals of prescription monitoring programs, again, not every state will have all of these goals, but all of the states will have at least two of these goals. Prescription monitoring is used as a tool for prescribers and pharmacists to assist them in evaluating patients for whom they are providing treatment to decide the best way to treat this patient, and if they detect that there is a problem of abuse or addiction, then it gives them the opportunity for early intervention and prevention of those types of problems. Education and information, both for healthcare providers and the public. Public health initiatives. It's very important to public health for people who have drug abuse or addiction problems to get into treatment. And this is one of the only ways to detect a lot of that on a widespread basis. And, of course, every program is very, very concerned and very protective of this patient-specific information. So we protect that confidentiality of the patient. Now let's look at exactly what drugs we're talking about. If you put all of the drugs in that there are, you can classify them in three categories. They're either over-the-counter drugs, prescription drugs, or they're drugs that are illegal except for research. Now, the drugs that we're talking about, you'll hear us talking about controlled substances. That is a very specific subset of drugs that have the potential for addiction and abuse. They're divided by the federal and state government into five schedules. Schedule 1 has no medical use in the United States. This would be things like heroin and LSD. Schedule 2, 3, and 4 have a high potential for abuse. Schedule 3 would be things like Vicodin or Tylenol with codeine. Schedule 4 would be things like Valium, Xanax, most of your diet pills. Schedule 2 would be things like Percocet, morphine, OxyContin. And then you have Schedule 5s, which are lower in their potential for abuse. Things like a lot of your cough syrups with codeine, both prescription and over-the-counter, would fall into this category. There are also a couple of pain relievers in Schedule 5 and some antidiarrheal products that fall into this category. Now, if you put the controlled substances and overlay that onto the universe of drugs, you've got Schedule 1 drugs, which are for research only. Schedule 2, 3, 4, and some of the 5s require a prescription, and then you've got a few over-the-counter Schedule 5s. So we are only talking in a prescription monitoring program about controlled substances, which is only 10%. And then in Senate Bill 34, we're only talking about a subset of that, which is Schedule 2, 3, and 4. So only about 9% of all the prescriptions dispensed in all the pharmacies for the constituents in Oregon would be affected by this program. Now, why do we need a program like this? Prescribers and pharmacists have a duty under federal and state law to monitor what they do, and they're treating patients for legitimate medical conditions. The responsibility is upon the prescribing practitioner, but a corresponding responsibility is on the dispensing pharmacist. So they have this legal obligation to make sure that they're using these drugs for medical uses and not for any other non-medical uses. So currently, without a prescription monitoring program, the only way they have of collecting this information is generally by making phone calls to other pharmacies and other practitioners or those informal professional contacts. So what you have is the people who need the information going to each individual pharmacy or entity trying to obtain what they need in order to treat an individual patient. If you have a prescription monitoring program in place, the pharmacies report the information on these controlled substances to your prescription monitoring program, who then makes that available to the pharmacists and doctors and other entities that have a legitimate need and right to get the information. Now, these are the current states with a prescription monitoring program in place. The states in maroon currently have a program that is operational. The states in the darker blue have enacted their legislation. They're in the process of implementing their program. I'm sorry, I believe you have a picture of this in some of your materials as well. And then the states in light blue considered legislation for a prescription monitoring program in 2006. And I know of several other states that are going to be considering this year. Washington State's program is a little bit unique because they, at the current time, they only monitor physicians whose practices are restricted, but they are moving probably this year to have a full prescription monitoring program just like everybody else. So Oregon will be surrounded by states with a prescription monitoring program. Now, coming from Ohio, let me direct your attention to Ohio. Until this last year, we also were surrounded by states with a prescription monitoring program, and we saw a drastic increase in the number of patients crossing borders coming into our state to get their controlled substances. Now, you might wonder, once you set a program up, who uses it? ORS is the acronym for the Ohio Automated Rx Reporting System. And our data in 2006, which we just got our program up and running in October of that year, but we did some statistics, and 65% of all of the requests for information come from prescribers. 27% of our requests come from pharmacists and only 8% from law enforcement. Now, I also wanted to look at another state, Kentucky. Kentucky is a much more mature program. They were up and running in 1999. Their numbers have continued to, the prescriber numbers continue to grow, and they're currently at 93% of all requests for data from that program come from prescribers. So it's overwhelmingly a prescriber, physician, nurse practitioner, physician assistant program, service program for these individuals that are treating patients. Now, why do they want the information? Again, they need some background on their patients. They want to know if this patient is going to other practitioners to obtain controlled substances. Is the patient telling them the truth when they ask about their prior use or other concurrent use or anything about the use of their controlled substances? And if it's someone that they're already treating, such as a chronic pain patient, they want to know that the patient is complying with the treatment program that they have given them, and the patient is doing what the practitioner wants them to do, and they have usually agreed to do. Now, when I talk about prescription monitoring programs, people are always very concerned, and rightly so, about the privacy issues. It's very interesting. These programs have been around since about 1940, starting in California. New York had a program very early on, and there was a lawsuit filed back in the 70s against the New York program. Among the other allegations was that the state collecting this information from prescriptions was an invasion of privacy. I've highlighted some of the things that some of the statements that the Supreme Court made in that case, and there's the citation there on the slide if you want further information. But the U.S. Supreme Court said in reviewing this program that the New York program does not establish a constitutional violation to privacy. Furthermore, the disclosures of private medical information does not automatically amount to an impermissible invasion of privacy. And the right of a state to use this is fine under the powers of the state as long as they have security measures in place to avoid unwarranted disclosures. So while it's, the Supreme Court has said, while it's okay to collect this data and use it for these purposes, the state does have a duty to make sure that it is only available to those people who should have access to it. Now, in recent years, we also have HIPAA that provides a lot of protection for patient health information. And the general rule of HIPAA is that you can't disclose health information, but HIPAA does contain a number of exemptions. These exceptions are disclosures that are required by law, disclosures for the purpose of treatment, disclosures for public health surveillance, and disclosures for law enforcement investigation. All of these are exempt from the HIPAA requirements. So these disclosures are permitted even under HIPAA. The minimum necessary rule, of course, does still apply. Now, most states also have some additional...
Excuse me. Would you talk about the minimum necessary rule?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, thank you. The minimum necessary rule under HIPAA is that while you may make disclosures, you should only disclose the amount of information that is necessary to fulfill that need at that time. So, for example, if a physician wants information from a pharmacy, then the pharmacy may provide that information but the pharmacy would not, for example, provide the physician every prescription that was ever prescribed for that patient, maybe by other physicians, if he or she was only concerned about what the patient had received in the last month. So it's tailored to the specific need and request, but the general rule is you give what is necessary to meet that requirement. So how this would apply to a prescription monitoring program is that the pharmacy would provide the information required by the statute and the rule to the prescription monitoring program, but would not provide any additional information. So they might provide the controlled substances, but not the non-controlled substances, which are not required. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and a step further, I believe we have statutory language that prevents phishing, that law enforcement cannot simply go keep asking for information. So it does narrow it down, and the minimum requirement focuses on what is asked for, nothing more.
Yes, it does. Also, Mr. Chair, as far as phishing goes, let me make one comment. The state statutes are usually pretty specific that the information is limited to information about a person. So that would preclude the law enforcement from getting, for example, a list of every patient who has received an OxyContin prescription. They have to tailor it to a specific individual of whom they are already investigating. So we definitely want to prevent phishing.
Yeah, thank you. Senator George?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Public health surveillance, what is that? Can you define it? And does it include the name of the individuals if it's what I think it is?
Well, public health surveillance would include things like a monitoring program. It might also include things such as a newborn screening registry, a tumor registry, brain injury registry, all of those types of registry things that usually public health departments track.
Would that be tied to a specific individual who might be in the database, or is it just generic? In other words, from this unit of people taking this, we got that kind of result.
That's an excellent question, Mr. Chair and Senator George. It would be both. It could be patient-specific. It would depend on the type of surveillance. I'm sure that some of those are patient-specific, and probably some others are not patient-specific.
Just a quick follow-up. That is outside of law enforcement, though. That would basically be just internally trying. Yeah, I see heads nodding that that's the answer to that, then. Okay.
Some of the ways that state statutes typically protect patient information is they only allow information from a prescription monitoring program to go to individuals, specifically named individuals, such as healthcare providers, typically use terms like practitioners, physician, prescriber, which could include nurse practitioners or physician assistants if they have prescribing authority in your state, healthcare licensing boards, law enforcement, and again, that's usually specifically tailored and defined to be a specific individual. The statutes also typically give a specific purpose for which the data can be used. Healthcare providers are allowed to use it only for treatment purposes, and law enforcement is a drug-related investigation with a specific name target. Many states also include some language in their prescription monitoring program that the data is not a public record, or there's something somewhere in the statutes that would preclude it being a public record. Some states allow the data to be used for research, but this is always de-identified information that does not have any personal identity attached to it. Often there are statements or rules or regulations, whatever you have here in Oregon, that would say that the data has to be purged or destroyed after a certain number of years. That limits the exposure of patients for their information to be disseminated. And then a lot of states or in most states that I'm aware of, also keep records of all the requests. So it's possible for the prescription monitoring program at any time to know who made a request, on whom they made a request, and for an individual person, who all made a request for information on this person, just to make sure that everything is done according to the statutes and the limitations set forth.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think after what happened in Florida that that's absolutely pertinent to be in there, that we don't want anybody to going out with political agendas or I'm going to get you type thing utilizing our database. So I'll probably ask questions of whether we're totally protected later. I didn't do that.
He did.
Let me just say that I forgot to mention earlier, but please turn off your cell phones and your Blackberries, because the Blackberry cell phones and computer Wi-Fi show up on the sound system.
And we know your name.
You're being monitored. Okay.
One of the most important things that I think can be in a prescription monitoring program, and it's in every program that I'm aware of, is none of these programs and statutes grant anyone access to patient-specific medical records that does not already have access to this information. So nobody's getting anything new. It's just a different way of obtaining the information. All of the pharmacists and the prescribers have access to it because they are treating, so that falls under the HIPAA exemption for treatment. Law enforcement can walk into a pharmacy if they have a subpoena, court order, whatever is required in your state. They can get access to that information on any individual, provided they go through the proper channels. The only thing that a prescription monitoring program does is it puts the records in one place. And actually, I believe there's greater security on the records in a prescription monitoring program than there is in the typical physician's office or pharmacy, because you think about it, there are a lot of people going in and out of a physician's office that if they wanted to could access those patient charts. But the prescription monitoring program is very specific about which individuals can request information. So this data is more secure here than it is in other places. Fewer people have access to the data unless there's a breach by the physician or the pharmacist. And of course, you have that risk with any type of medical information. So there's no greater risk by having the data in a prescription monitoring program than already exists. These prescribers and pharmacists are covered by the HIPAA requirements. There's recourse if one of these individuals breaches that confidentiality. And then there are also usually state law penalties for breach of a prescription monitoring program data. People always ask about security issues. There are a number of ways, and I'm just going to talk briefly about some of these. I'm not a technology guru by any means. But there's a lot of technology out there to help protect the data once it's in the database. Some of the things that you can do is have the information on separate servers, separate networks. There's a lot of software and firewalls that can be put into place. There's physical security, such as locking those servers in a separate room, limiting access via the computer to only the people that operate the prescription monitoring program and things like that. Another security issue is use the term identity management. And all this means is making sure that the person who is getting this information is who they say they are and that they do meet the requirements of the statute for getting that information. So, in other words, a physician would be credentialed prior to getting the first report to make sure that they were, in fact, a physician, that they did have a current license, current DEA registration, or whatever your requirements would be. And states vary on how they credential people to get access to the information. Some of them do it initially, some of them with a renewal, some of them do it with every request. So there are various ways, but it's very important to make sure that these people are who they say they are and that they do meet the qualifications of the statutes. You can also have a lot of security by your policies, such as no information is provided by phone. You don't know who you're talking to over the phone. So in Ohio, we have a very strict policy that we will not discuss any patient's information over the phone. We also will not provide any information without an account. I might know that the person standing in my office is a physician, that he or she is licensed, but until they have been through the credentialing process and have established an account with us, we're not going to provide any information. And we credential every person who seeks information. Our own online accounts, ours is a web-based program. That's the way most of the states are moving away from paper processes. But the online accounts only to persons who are named in the statute, and direct access to that database only by the personnel who operate the program. In Ohio, there are only three people that can touch that database. I can touch it, and my two computer people can touch it. Other staff, even within the Board of Pharmacy, cannot access that database. We use a vendor to collect information from the pharmacies. That vendor that gives us the pharmacy information cannot touch our database. Everything goes through one of those three people. So that's just one of our security measures. Now, some things that I'm sorry Senator Morissette is not in here for this part, because he has been very interested in what are the ramifications and what are the consequences of developing a program like this. Well, some things are intended. We intend, when we set these programs up, for the demand or the request for this data to increase. We've seen that particularly within the Kentucky program, since I've had the most experience with that. But other states confirm the same thing. As more and more physicians become aware of the program, their use increases. If the program works like it should, we never look for a decrease in the number of pills dispensed. I don't think that's a good measure of effectiveness. I really like to see an increase in the number of pills dispensed, because that's telling me that more physicians are more comfortable prescribing whatever it is a patient needs. If a patient needs it for a legitimate medical condition, I don't care how much they get. It is irrelevant. But if they need a boxcar load for their legitimate medical condition, then that's what they should have. The quantity is irrelevant. The important thing is that that patient gets appropriate medical care. And we would also like to see an increase in the number of family practitioners who will treat pain. What I'm seeing typically right now is there are not enough pain specialists to treat all the people who have chronic pain, to say nothing of cancer pain and other types of pain. So we need the family practitioners to help monitor and follow these patients. But a lot of the family practitioners are not comfortable because they're afraid. Programs like this typically give them the reassurance that they need to go ahead and take care of these patients. So we'd like to see an increase in the number of physicians who will treat patients for pain. Now, there are some consequences that are foreseeable. If you've got more physicians, more prescribers evaluating patients and looking at prescription drug histories for controlled substances, there's going to be an increase in the abuse and addiction cases that are identified. So there's going to be an increased demand and need for drug abuse treatment. We also will see persons crossing state lines to obtain or fill prescriptions if they can go to a state that does not have a prescription monitoring program. Let me relate just a little bit of the experience that Ohio had when I was running the program in Kentucky. After about 3 years, when the program was pretty the information among physicians was pretty widespread. The program was being utilized significantly. I started getting phone calls from Ohio and from Tennessee asking me, what is going on? Why are all these people coming to our state to get their prescriptions filled? So this is a consequence that's foreseeable. Oregon being surrounded by states with a prescription monitoring program, if you don't have it, will probably tend to be a haven for these type of people, and that's not something that's probably in your best interest. The unintended consequences of establishing a prescription monitoring program, I would expect to see an increasing use of aliases and false addresses, not by patients with legitimate medical conditions, but by persons who want to divert these controlled substances. And we would also it will also support e-prescribing. E-prescribing, I'm sure you're very familiar with it, is prescribing by computer directly to a pharmacy. This it would give a physician access to a patient's complete medical record, all of the drugs that they're taking, and so this is just one step that we can take now to provide the information about controlled substances until e-prescribing becomes pervasive and available. Here are some websites that have some information if you need more information about prescription monitoring programs in various states. All of these have information on their website, and I've included my contact information. If you have questions at any time later on, please feel free to contact me.
The prescribing and kids are getting underage people are getting prescriptions illegitimately over e-prescribing. Is there anything that has been done about this that's effective? Is there any controls out there to protect the public, and to protect parents, and to protect, you know, that's a way around this bill in some ways, right?
Mr. Chair, could you give me a little bit more detail? I'm not understanding the scenario.
Okay, there are
the
certain
scenario.
Things that we regulate in the state of Oregon that are not regulated on the Internet, and so people can use the Internet to get around laws that we have, and that goes for gambling, it goes for buying liquor, it goes for prescription drugs. Has there been any efforts made that you're aware of to control this? Is that a federal issue? Is that a state issue? I don't know.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question that I've not addressed. Prescription monitoring programs typically don't include Internet pharmacy. Jurisdiction is a huge issue here. The feds are trying to address that issue. Because the Internet pharmacies are not licensed in the individual states, there's no leverage to get them to report. So that's kind of outside the jurisdiction of a prescription monitoring program. And some of the studies that I'm seeing are saying that the use of the Internet may not be as big a factor as we once thought in the amount of the drugs that get on the street, and especially the ones that are available to children.
Okay. Good.
Mr. Chair, yes. a lot of those Internet pharmacies aren't even in the United States, so that makes it even more difficult.
That's true. Other questions? Yes, Senator George.
Thanks. I want to double-check to make sure we get that on the record. If we put the system in place and we're surrounded by Idaho and Washington and California, and they have a similar program, if anybody would shop across state lines, the system will pick it up and put it back in the database that person shopped California. It will not.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, this is another excellent question. At the present time, the way prescription monitoring programs work, each state collects information from the pharmacies that they license. There's right now a pilot project that's about to be implemented between California and Nevada to do some data sharing on a limited basis. We recognize that this is a problem, and this is one of the things that we are going to be working toward, more data sharing among states to take care of this kind of issue. In fact, Ohio has applied for the 2007 grant, and what we are going to be doing is working on data sharing with our surrounding states.
thank you. And there may be some questions, so later on. Kathy Hahn, would you like to make a brief statement, and then we'll move on to some of the...
Thank you, Chair Morissette and Senate committee members. My name is Kathy Hahn. I am a community pharmacist in Springfield, Bi-Mart, and I'm also chair of the Pain Management Commission. I have a statement from the Pain Commission. The Oregon Pain Commission opposed electronic prescription monitoring in 2005 based on potential abuse by law enforcement, its resultant targeting of large quantity opioid prescribers, and the encroachment upon the civil liberties of patients taking pain medications for legitimate use. At the time, the Commission was concerned about a potential chilling effect on prescribers of controlled substances. We were also concerned about any potential effect on Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, as it was scrutinized by U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft. The climate became decidedly chilly for prescribers when the DEA published an interim statement that advised doctors could be investigated at any time for little reason. Many on the Pain Commission felt that that in a time of increased scrutiny due to the government's war on prescription drug abuse, a real or perceived risk of regulatory censure would decrease legitimate pain patients' ability to receive adequate care. The Pain Commission acknowledged the obvious potential benefits of this electronic monitoring to prescribers, patients, and the public. It was determined that the time was not right, the discussion not lengthy enough, input on the bill's wording not adequate, and results from other states with the program not clear enough. The Wisconsin Pain and Policy Studies Group urged caution. In 2006, Pain Commission Vice Chair Susan Yasensky and I joined a coalition to work on wording of a new bill and to voice concerns that the commission had. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its ruling that Oregon had the right to have its Death with Dignity program. The DEA backtracked on previous statements that caused great concern to prescribers. The climate of fear was reduced by a degree. By June of 2006, the Pain Commission could cautiously support the new bill with these remaining concerns. The program must provide notification of data collection to persons impacted. Number two, the Commission strongly urged a public conversation about the program to alert consumers before passage of this bill. Number three, the Commission's position of concern about potential abuse by law enforcement, including data mining, had not changed. The Commission felt that Oregon faced a greater crisis in a lack of providers treating pain. It was hoped that the bill would ultimately improve the availability of care by increasing the number of willing practitioners who treat pain and consequently improve the lives of people suffering needlessly within the state of Oregon. Through the rest of 2006, fact-gathering coalition rewording efforts continued. The Pain Commission was pleased to see that a permanent commission would be created to oversee this program with representatives from 13 organizations, including the Pain Commission. Jennifer Boland, JD, an out-of-state expert in defending prescribers, was brought in to answer questions about other states' programs. Boland reminded us of the devastating and increasing occurrence of prescription drug abuse and the health professionals' responsibility to be a partner in preventing this. She reported that no program data base had been compromised. Doctors were immensely relieved to have a tool to reduce their fear of prescribing controlled substances and increase the provision of safe care. The Commission learned that new wording created a near lockout of law enforcement, easing our fears of regulatory abuse. We also learned that a provision was made to notify patients that they will be entered into a database at the time they filled a controlled substance prescription. In fact, it was believed that Oregon would be the first state to enact this type of notification. The only stipulation that remains is the public forum piece, which the Commission continues to strongly encourage. The Commission's charge is to represent the concerns of pain patients to the Governor and Legislative Assembly. For us to do that, we must have public dialogue on this issue. It is important to acknowledge that should this bill pass and become law, we must mount a vigorous educational effort to counteract any possible chilling effect on the prescribing of controlled substances. Fortunately, this effort would fit in nicely with the Commission's mandatory pain education requirement for all health care practitioners. It is even possible that the mention of the program and how it works to benefit the prescriber and society could be included in the one-hour mandatory program that the Pain Commission created and maintains. Finally, Mr. Chair and Senate Committee members, the climate appears to be right. Our concerns are greatly diminished, and we believe we have a well-written bill that will benefit patients, providers, and society by balancing adequate and available pain care with drug abuse prevention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I might add that Senator Lonis Anderson is a member of the Okay. Thank you very much. And you might sit in the front row there in case we need to call you back. There are a few people who traveled over 100 miles. Dr. Robert Peterson. Bob. Rob Bovet.
Did they come down?
Yes. Yes, come on. And let's see. Okay, these are the individuals who've traveled a long way, so we'll start with you guys. You want to introduce
Sir,
yourself?
Thank you. I'm Dr. Robert Peterson. I'm the medical director at the Coastal Family Health Center in Astoria, Oregon. We are the federally qualified health center, community supported in Clatsop County. And we serve the area as well as areas of Washington and outside Clatsop County. We provide care to patients with no insurance who are underinsured or Medicaid, and we're the only folks in Clatsop County in Astoria seeing Medicaid patients at this time. I come to you as a prescriber. I come to you as the medical director for our clinic. I come to you also as a parent and a citizen in the county. We have a very serious epidemic and have for years of prescription drug abuse and diversion in our county. My sixth grader, who goes to church 3 days a week and dance the others, can tell me who can she at least state she knows who she can get methadone, Percocet, and other prescription drugs from at her school. And the other kids in the neighborhood offer similar information to me. We know I'm not here to present those statistics, but that's just common community knowledge. In the last 2 months of 2006, we lost 5 people in our county to overdoses or deaths due to abuse of prescribed medications. Most of these folks were women under the age of 50 with children who became addicted to medication originally prescribed for a real problem, but became enamored with the effects of the medication, doctor shopped and used higher and higher doses of medication from a number of sources. Ultimately, most of these were abusing the fentanyl patch, which is a drug which is placed on a Band-Aid-like device placed on the skin, so there's slow, continuous absorption of medication. But there are other ways of increasing absorption of this medication, such as putting a heating pad over the patch, or opening the patch up and putting the medicine in your nose, or there are a couple other ways of trying to absorb it as well, and people have died from this. One of the deaths occurred in an automobile accident, and the victim's daughter was in the car, fortunately not killed. We expect that without the ability for us to identify the folks that are abusing the medications, we can't help them. I just started at my job in October. We set up a new program for how we monitor and handle our patients on narcotic pain medication. We've identified over 100 patients so far that we no longer prescribe narcotics to who showed strong evidence of abuse and or diversion. I suspect there's at least 100 more in our practice that we're not able to positively identify. And we don't want to deny somebody that does need medication just because we think that they might be somebody who's diverting. A program like this will provide us an immense amount of information and save us an immense amount of time. Right now, we have a list of about 20 pharmacies that when we have a patient we're concerned about, one of our aides has to get on the phone and call each pharmacy and find out, has so-and-so gotten a prescription for a narcotic in the past 2 months besides the one we prescribe? That's a horrid waste of resources in a clinic that's already has a 600-patient waiting list to get in, and we're having to waste time do things like that every day just to try to take care of the patients we have now. I've been practicing medicine for 30 years. I was a medical oncologist for 17 of those years, treating cancer patients and patients with blood disorders who have a great need and demand for narcotics. I practiced in the state of Michigan before and after they enacted their programs for monitoring, as well as Tennessee, which is starting one of these programs right now. And I can say that the benefits of such a program are great. I've seen no negative effects from them whatsoever. I've seen a lot of people concerned about them, but I've not seen any really negative things happen. What I've seen is, just as described for us, that people actually feel more comfortable prescribing the medications the patient need because they know they're not being fooled. And now, as a primary care physician, when a patient comes into my office and says, I have this back pain that's been bothering me for a long time, I have no way of, there's no blood test I can do, there's no x-ray I can do that can tell me whether that patient's hurting or not. And as a compassionate physician, I want to be able to do what I can do to relieve their pain. But with a simple phone call, I find out that they've been to four other physicians in the past week and received narcotic prescriptions from them. I can feel safe not prescribing medication to that patient, or alternatively, if they haven't, I feel that I can trust them with their story and go ahead and take care of them appropriately. And without using a huge amount of my own limited resources in the office, already overburdened with the things we're trying to take care of. That's, you know, my major concern. I was not aware this bill was coming up. I actually, a week or two ago, just was called the Board of Pharmacy cold to find out what was happening, because I was very concerned. And I was pleased to hear this was happening today and made a big effort to come here on my own so I could give you my input. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay in touch.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm here today wearing my hat as a representative for the Governor's Meth Task Force and President of the Oregon Alliance for Drug Endangered Children, both of which entities strongly support this bill, and the Governor's Meth Task Force unanimously endorsed it. I'll keep my comments very brief. I'd like to just touch on a couple of the issues that were mentioned before and kind of encapsulate it in what is commonly used as a three-legged stool of prevention, enforcement, and treatment. This bill holds out some hope. It holds out some hope to empower doctors and physicians and pharmacists to engage in some prevention activities to avoid some of the prescription drug abuse that we're currently being plagued with. Plus, I think it also enhances, as mentioned before, a physician's comfort zone to prescribe medication. In terms of enforcement, you know, some of the states out there actually have law enforcement agencies operating these programs, and we still have not seen abuses. We're not even proposing that here. We're talking about the Board of Pharmacy running it, and we've actually built in some, what I consider some very extreme measures to preclude law enforcement from abusing this act. We've said they have to get a court order. And then guess what? Even if they get a court order, they can't use it in court. Talk about a disincentive to law enforcement use of a database. I mean, I got to tell you, let's be blunt. We've lost 40% of our narcotics teams and 40% of our narcotics officers in the state of Oregon in the last 10 years. That's a tragic circumstance. But I got to tell you, the guys that I wear a different hat at different times. The guys that I represent on that field are struggling. They can't meet the demand, the need. Actually, adding more workload to them is beyond the pale. They're not looking for more work to do. They're being overtaxed as it is. This is a very unappetizing bill for them, which is what we want it to be. I share the civil liberties concerns, and I like this bill better than what I saw in 2005, and that comes from a perspective of a law enforcement lawyer. Finally, on treatment, I believe this will increase the demand and the load for treatment access, and I'll be back before this committee to talk about a very important bill on Monday, Senate Bill 184, which is a piece of what we need to be doing to get us off the bottom, because right now, unfortunately, in Oregon, we're fourth in the nation for treatment demand per capita for young adults, and we're 49th in the nation for treatment access for that same population. That's social suicide, and we need to correct that. And I think we have a plan to correct that, and we'll start that correction on Monday. And so I look forward to coming back and talking to you about treatment. This is an early intervention tool. This is a prevention tool, and this is a treatment tool. And I hope you look at it in that way. Thank you.
Are you going to show up at every committee I'm on? Or
if it relates to addiction and treatment, you're probably right, Senator. Any questions for me? Thank you.
Okay, let's go down the list here. Martin Klaus.
Chairman Morissette, Senate committee members. My name is Martin Klaus, and I have worked as a pain management physician for approximately 10 years in Oregon. Currently, my office is in Springfield. For the last 3 years, I've also been treating opiate-addicted patients with Suboxone as an outpatient basis. My office was the first outpatient office in Oregon to start this treatment. I'm also a member of the Lane County Mental Health Advisory Committee, and I am the chairman of the Lane County Coalition to Prevent Substance Abuse. As a pain management physician, I've run into almost every roadblock to the care of pain patients that it's possible to run into in this state. Every pain management physician is aware of and concerned about drug abuse, addiction, and diversion. When I first started working in pain management exclusively in Oregon, local budgets were good. If I was seeing a new pain patient, I would call a contact, a local gentleman, who was with the Lane County Internet Agency Task Force, Interagency Narcotics Task Force, and ask if that patient's name had ever appeared as suspicious for drug abuse or sales activity. Now, what I was doing was slightly illegal, but it was the only way I could get information to find out whether my patients were of concern to the police agencies. Since state and county budgets have been cut, though, that telephone call is no longer available to me. To get the same information, we have also researched and occasionally used county websites to search for convictions for drug activity for our brand new patients. This gives me a small measure of support, but I realize that most addicts and most drug dealers who are diverting drugs from doctors' offices have not been convicted and so would not be identified online. I've been investigated over 14 times by the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners for allegedly overprescribing opiates to pain patients to help them control their pain. I have had to take multiple classes mandated by the state board that deal with the management of pain in the difficult patient. My license was placed on probation by the board for the last 4 years now as a means of forcing my compliance with their peer review program and the mandated classes. My license is still on probation with the medical board as I speak to you today. However, in response to this, I've spent the last 4 years and over $20,000 of my own funds, both in complying with the state board directions and in further educating myself to improve my ability to distinguish pain patients from patients with the disease of addiction. My study has culminated in my sitting for the certification test in addiction medicine in December 2006. I now work for the State Board of Medical Examiners, while still on probation with my license, through the Oregon Medical Association as a peer reviewer. I am now reviewing other doctors' use of pain medication. Because of an earlier statement, I must say that I'm speaking today as a private practitioner, not as a representative of the OMA. And you'll know why in a moment. So I am trying to help other doctors who were in the same position I was in 4 years ago. I work to teach them to better understand what the board's expectations are. My medical practice currently consists of three groups of patients. The first group is the most typical pain patient. This patient is commonly the person who has significant life-altering pain, not improved by physical therapy, counseling, injection, surgery, or other methods. He or she is usually taking three or more Vicodin hydrocodone pills per day from their primary care doctor. Their doctor has become afraid that they will be in trouble with the medical board or with other regulatory agencies if they continue therapy. So they look for the specialist for the pain patient to see who will take over that prescriptions of medications. They hope to avoid scrutiny, but also hope that the specialist can improve on the medication mix and the types of medications to allow the patient improved function. This patient is often, however, an undiscovered opiate addict, perhaps as much as 10 to 15% of the time. We vastly, vastly underestimate the amount of addiction in our society. The pain specialist has to discern whether the patient's need for medication is due to pain or addiction. And again, as you heard previously, there are no tests. There are no blood tests. There are no x-rays. If you looked at my x-ray of my back right now, you'd see a herniated disc that would make you cry. And I don't have pain, but I could sure use it to get medications. I've treated these patients in several states now for a total of 23 years. I can tell you frankly that discerning the difference between an addict and a pain patient is a monumental task. Unfortunately, our addicted patients do not wear signs or tattoos that give away their disease. Indeed, these people, contrary to popular belief, are often extremely intelligent. After all, they're surviving in a very dangerous and difficult environment, getting their drugs on the street. They're often experts at scamming the doctors for drugs. They're experts because they're trained by the best doctors we have in the state. Every time they've tried to scam a doctor for drugs and succeeded, they've learned more about what works to get their drugs of abuse. Every time they have failed with a doctor, they have learned something new about what does not work to get their drugs. The doctors themselves have no idea of their own complicity in this training of the addict. The bill before you would help both the pain specialist and the family doctor in this circumstance. Allowing them to check on the patient's medication usage, out-of-control usage, is a hallmark of addiction. It would also allow them to check on whether or not the patient is compliant with his or her agreement with their doctor to receive controlled substances from only one doctor at a time. As an aside, I and many other physicians, but not nearly all, try to write our scheduled prescriptions on safety paper that is supposed to be uncopyable. In the last 6 months, one of my pain patients was found to be using a photo-perfect copier to copy my prescriptions. I would have known this if I could have seen how many times, four times, he was filling every prescription that I wrote him each month. Tracking this down, when we had an inkling this was going on, took 2 afternoons of telephone calls to every pharmacy in Lane County, Linn County, and Douglas County by my office staff. All three of them were working solid for straight 8 hours to get this done, to find out where this guy was filling his prescriptions. The second group of patients I treat are diagnosed as pain patients, but also are addicts. Because of my more recent education and, of course, my outspokenness on this issue, I have slowly become the pain management doctor of referral for a wide area now for patients that have both chronic pain and have at the same time been identified as addicts by their treating doctors. Ethically and morally, I feel these patients do deserve treatment for their pain if that can be done in a way that does not activate or worsen their addiction. These are extremely complex patients, and they're referred to my office for medication management because of my acquired dual expertise in dealing with these issues now. Obviously, these patients are kept on a very tight observant schedule, but it would be much easier if I could also be able to see what medications they might be getting from other physicians. A recent patient was found to be getting methadone from both myself and another pain management doctor, both of us prescribing in good faith, neither knowing about the other's prescriptions. This was, again, because of the intelligence of the patient in scamming us to get medications from both at once. Of course, he had passed all your analysis tests. He was taking the methadone we prescribed, but was taking an extremely high dose of this deadly drug by working 2 doctors at once. Lastly, I also treat addicts for their opiate addiction. This group of patients is managed using a new medication called Suboxone, released 3 years ago. Because of federal law, I'm unable to contact their primary doctors or others about their care without distinct written permission from the patient directly. Understand that there is a federal law that is far stronger than HIPAA that says if I mention this patient to any other physician, I go to jail. End of story. Suboxone, if combined with any of the commonly used sedatives for anxiety, seizures, or sleep, can be a fatal drug to the patient. Of course, my patients are warned about this deadly interaction, but because of the stigma of their addiction, these patients are often afraid to tell their primary care doctor that I am treating them or what I am treating them with. In the last 3 years, we have now caught on urinalysis or through luck 3 patients taking potentially fatal interacting drug mixes unbeknownst to either themselves or their primary care doctors. Even when their doctor knows that they're taking Suboxone, this is a new drug, and the doctors may not be familiar with the cautions associated with the drug. A prescription monitoring program would have allowed a lot earlier detection of this threat to my patients' lives. I'm not here to advocate that addicts be treated any different than any other patient, but like several other diseases, sometimes the discovery of a patient's addiction by their primary care doctor or their pain management specialist is the first intervention that leads to treatment. I was excited to hear that this is recognized federally now, that this bill should lead to increased amount of treatment, not because they need the business, but because the patients need the help. Recently, I've been also made aware by the DEA that my DEA number has been used to forge prescriptions for hydrocodone called into several pharmacies in the Portland region. It is not at all difficult to get any physician's DEA number. In fact, these are now available in a downloadable format from the DEA itself. The fee to download this information is equal to the street value of 60 Vicodin pills. The database would have allowed me to monitor my recorded prescription activity and warned the pharmacies that they were being scammed before the DEA ever had to be involved. It is not nice having those gentlemen come into my office. This would allow a lot less diversion onto the streets of Portland in this case. This was, and if I remember correctly, in these three sets of prescriptions that were going out on a monthly basis, there were at least 1,000 Vicodin pills. Understand, street value of those drugs is $2 to $5 a piece. Prescription drug diversion is a real and very large problem in Oregon. As I said, hydrocodone sells for $2 to $5 per pill on the streets of Portland, according to some of my addiction patients. Hydrocodone is the most abused drug in Oregon because it can be called into a pharmacy. They don't need a written prescription. It is a Schedule 3. It is not our worst problem in our state, but it is overshadowing our good medical care of patients in pain. Finally, there are more wide-ranging uses for prescription monitoring. An unconscious patient taken to the local emergency room can be treated faster for drug interactions or side effects if the emergency doctor can get a list of their patient's prescriptions online. I'd be glad to help pay for the cost of this program through a licensing fee, as opposed to what the OMA said. The staff cost alone of trying other bulky and slow and inefficient methods of discovering patients who are scamming us would be paid for many times over by a license fee for this database. I've discussed this concept with other doctors in my community. As with any regulation, there is fear of increased scrutiny by the doctors. But the protections provided in this bill, as I read it, would make almost all of the doctors comfortable with the idea of the database that they can use. I do not by any means believe that bringing Oregon up to the standards of the rest of the states around us will have a chilling effect on pain management in our state. Our state has an overall shortage of doctors, but the doctors we have here are high quality. They are looking for help with an issue of scheduled prescriptions. Many of them are afraid that without the help, they will get in trouble from police agencies for prescribing to addicts, which is a felony. Doctors, as a rule, are smart people. Just ask them. They do not want jail time for just trying to do their job. It is easier for the doctors to simply avoid treating pain patients, and far too many of them are now doing this. Most of the patients I see would be better handled by their primary care doctor. They don't need a specialist, but their doctors are afraid. This database and subsequent education of doctors on how to work with it will make them much more comfortable. Without help like this, I myself am thinking of stopping all pain management just to work in addiction medicine now. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
A related question. Thank you for your testimony. It was absolutely tremendous. But, Mr. Chair, I was a member of the task force that created the Pain Commission way back when, and also helped move the legislation to get it created. And one of the things that we were emphasizing at that point in time was that the BME would change their culture and not go on witch hunts. Are they still doing that, or has the culture changed?
This is difficult to answer.
This is difficult to answer because I'm one of their targets. However, I honestly believe that the Board of Medical Examiners is doing the best they can in a difficult environment. They have had some expert testimony to their own board from physicians who are not, how best to say it is, they're not up on current addiction medicine treatment and not up on current problems in the field. So that was some difficulty in my case. I've worked incredibly hard over the last 4 years to re-educate them. I visit with them on a regular basis, as you might guess. And over the last 2 years now, the board has several times asked me to, on my own, to rescind my probation. I have to request that. I have not requested that. They gave me a 5-year probation. I have said I will do my time and play your game simply so that I maintain contact with them on a every 3-month basis, working through their system.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, and then I do have another meeting.
But we also have to move on.
So okay, I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that maybe we have the BME come in and talk to us about how they've changed the culture to make physicians more comfortable with dealing with pain, because that clearly is one of the tasks we put upon them several years ago at this point. So,
yes, sir.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
We're running short, but there is one other. Anna Ulster, would you please come up? And then Alan Sporn after this. Alan Sporn, Michael Douglas. No. Michael Long. Okay. And then Andrea will come up. And we're running out of time. We're going to be out here in 15 minutes, so we're going to have to. Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Morissette and Senate Committee members, thank you for the opportunity. I am Ann Uhler. I am the chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. And I have, we support this bill, and I just want to do this very briefly, but for three reasons. One is, and some of this has been said, we just want to underscore it, is that we think that people suffering from the chronic disease of addiction will be better served by this bill. Doctors can be unaware that a patient who's prescribed pain medication may be psychologically addicted as well as physically addicted to the medication they have prescribed and may be seeking additional medication from other doctors. So this system will allow a doctor to learn if other medications are being prescribed. And by doing a brief assessment and referral to addiction treatment, and that is one of our actual concerns here, is that there needs to be some kind of training for all doctors about how to do a brief assessment and intervention with people who are addicted. That's not part of their regular training, and it's important that they be able to recognize this, and we've got to have more treatment so they've got some place to refer them to. And that's another chapter that we'll come to in later hearings. Second, when the doctor and pharmacist have knowledge of medication being prescribed, the risk of severe drug interactions, possible reduction of clinical effectiveness of a medication, and the possibility of drug overdose and death can be minimized. And then finally, why we support this is that we believe that patients with severe pain and who are not abusing their medications will receive their medications without having to regularly justify the prescriptions, because both the doctor and pharmacist have more information and the confidence in the pharmacy system. Thank you again for taking the time to hear input on, and we appreciate it.
Any questions? Thank you. Alan, would you come up, please? And Michael Long. Welcome to both of you. Alan, it's good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, thank you for the time. I'll offer a different perspective. I think it's tremendous that there's a lot of testimony from people with a lot of expertise, but often what gets left out is the perspective of the person who is suffering intense pain and, in fact, taking OxyContin, methadone, Neurontin, all these different drugs you're hearing about. They're all in my body right now as I sit here before you. So let me give you a little different perspective. But I think turns some of what you've heard before upside down. At least I hope it will. Let me also say that I will pay a price for being here today. The pain will increase tomorrow, and it may be increased for several days. But this was important to me, so I drove up here to...
For the record, give your name.
Oh, Alan Siporin. I live in Eugene.
Okay,
actually,
that's good. Thank you.
Senator Morissette's district.
Oh,
I know you know every constituent. So.
Well, I don't know.
Okay. My mother was born with a rare illness, so rare that it had no name throughout her lifetime. And she went to Mayo Clinic, and they were stumped. She suffered incredible pain every 2 to 3 weeks of her life. You know, pain is relative. It's hard to describe pain in a way that makes sense. As the different doctors have said, they can't tell if someone's faking a bad back or not. My mother almost died giving birth to my brother. It was a breech birth. She described the average attack that she received from this illness every 2 to 3 weeks as worse than that breech birth that almost killed her. No one thought of using narcotics in those days. She basically resigned herself that every 2 to 3 weeks of her life she would suffer screaming, agonizing pain, and then it would be over, and then she'd be okay for 2 weeks or 10 days or 3 weeks, maybe a month if she was really lucky. When we went to Mayo Clinic, they told us that at least the illness wasn't fatal. 8 years later, she died from an attack of it. She was 51. I was 16 at the time. The illness is hereditary. I also have this same illness. And I suffered the first 25 to 30 years of my life the same way. Every 2 to 3 weeks of my life, I lived with agonizing, screaming pain. And I saw no other alternative. That's the way I was raised, by a woman who had put up with it herself. But I was lucky. By accident, I got connected with a doctor at the medical school in Portland who was doing research on some similar kinds of illnesses. And by the time I was 30, I was taking experimental medication that gave me almost complete relief from this illness. The next 20 years, I probably lived a fairly normal life if you don't count back surgery, knee surgery, a botched surgery, and a brain tumor. But I don't count those, as I do the first illness I described and the one I'm about to describe, which in essence means that lightning struck me twice. Another mysterious illness appeared for me about 10 years ago. The pain started getting worse and worse over the months. I saw more and more doctors, Western, Eastern, alternative, many different kinds of medication. Eventually, I resigned myself as the pain became more and more intolerable. And this pain didn't go away for 2 or 3 weeks. It was there all the time. It just kept getting worse. Yet I would have to do what I didn't want to do, which was go to pain management and start taking, as they prescribed, narcotics. We experimented with a lot of other medications first. None of them worked. The only thing that gave me any relief was doses of OxyContin with a frequency that the insurance companies wouldn't abide by, even though my doctor was prescribing it. So I had to get that overridden in the first step. OxyContin, methadone together, and some other drugs I listed give me enough relief to be here now talking to you and to occasionally substitute doing the work that I did for 20 years. But when I do that work, which is a talk show host, I'll pay a heavy price by being in incredible pain for the next week, even though I only work 2 or 3 days. But for that matter, if I just go out to a noisy restaurant with my wife, I'm likely to be in pain for the next week, or at least the next day, even taking a lot of extra drugs. So that's the reality that I live with. I want to lay out this one important thing, and then I'm going to talk about what it's like to get medication under the circumstances that anybody like me lives with. We all know the bedrock principle to our legal system. Better 10 guilty people go free than one innocent person be falsely imprisoned. But in the world of pain management through the use of narcotics, the guiding principle seems to be that 10 innocent suffering people suffer even more, often intolerable pain, than one drug abuser get away with a few extra pills. And that's the one overriding contradiction that I've heard here today. These are really good people who care about people who are suffering, pharmacists, doctors. I'm blessed with an incredibly great pain doctor, and I've been blessed with great pharmacists that I've been in situations where I would not have been able to get my medication if not for them. But this idea is lost on people who are so concerned with drug abusers that they forget about the chronic pain sufferers, or at least put them on the back burner. I know it's unfair to say they forget about them, because I heard the one doctor say he's so overly concerned about them, and I think they all are. But when we start talking about something like this bill that I hear and I'm opposed to, what scares me is that, in fact, the person who really needs the drugs that we finally have, the kind of drugs that my mother and I didn't have when she was alive, the kind of drugs that make my life livable now, we might run into problems. For example, Paul Jones goes in to get his prescription filled. And let me lay out first this little course that you have to run, this obstacle course that you have to run. With narcotics, you don't get to just phone in your prescription a week ahead of time and go pick them up. You have to go personally to the pain doctor's office. And if you phone it in too early, they'll reject it and say you're phoning it in too early because they're concerned about drug abuse. So you have to phone it in just a few days beforehand. If you forget, and you're talking about people who are on disorienting drugs, they could be in big trouble. So you have to phone it in. You have to go pick it up, then you go to the pharmacy, and you get it the day your drugs run out. maybe one day ahead. If there's any snafu, there's no leeway to deal with the problems of running out and what happens to you. Well, pain doctors are always experimenting with trying to get you something better. So even though the drugs that I'm on now seem to be the best mix for me, they're not perfect. As I described, I go through a lot of pain still. So I tried the patch you heard described here before. And the instructions that I got weren't quite right. I mean, people were concerned that I not be on the current drugs and the patch at the same time because then I would be overloaded with too much narcotics. So I quit taking the narcotics I was on in pill form and put the patch on. But there was too much of a gap. And the pain started going crazy. And I couldn't believe how bad the pain was. And then I started feeling nauseous on top of that, which was not a symptom that I ordinarily get. And I felt disoriented. Happened to be a Friday afternoon. The doctor's office was closed. Eventually, I was in such bad shape that my wife drove me to the emergency room, where there was a 3 to 4 hour wait. Luckily, I borrowed a phone, called a friend of mine who's a doctor, who said, "You're going through withdrawal. The patch isn't working for you. Your body is now empty of drugs, and you're going through withdrawal, the beginning stages of withdrawal, and there's nothing you can do except wait there until the emergency room takes you." He said, "I can't prescribe it because I'm your friend. I'll get in trouble. I haven't seen you as a doctor. The other doctor's offices are closed." So I'm crawling the walls in the emergency room, and I hear a guy down the hall screaming, and I said, "What's going on?" And they said, "Well, this guy's just faking it. He wants to get drugs." And I'm wondering what I'm going to do when I go in. There's nothing I can do. See, the opposite side of the perspective you're not hearing, the perspective you heard was, we can't tell if someone's faking it. But if you're really in pain, you can't prove that you're not faking it. You know, it's based on individual relationships with doctors and pharmacists, not with some universal system that overrides everything else. So let me get back to the example. Other than to say I went through a weekend of hell and I know what it's like to go through withdrawal, I don't want to go through that again, or at least part of withdrawal. Plus, it's not just withdrawal. It's not just the withdrawal that an addict goes through. It's the pain that you were getting away from with the pills is now coming on 2, 3, 4 times worse than you can imagine it, because when pain is removed or decreased, your mind forgets how bad it really is. And you really want to die when it comes back. You literally want to die. And I believe that people who do not have the kind of support system that I have will kill themselves, probably have killed themselves, because they don't get the needed medication for pain management. It's a serious, serious problem. So what happens now under this system that you're considering? Paul Jones goes in to get his OxyContin and methadone filled, and he's told, they check the system and they say, "Well, you just got it filled 5 days ago." He says, "No, I didn't. I just got the prescription. This is when I fill it." I said, "No, I've checked the database. It just got filled." Well, maybe there's a way to figure out what's going wrong. There's another Paul Jones in Idaho, and they'll figure it out. But by the time they figure it out, maybe it's too late for him. In my case, if you went 3 hours, I would be in excruciating pain. If you went another 6 hours, I'd be in withdrawal. The one pill I take in 48 hours, if I got an attack, my childhood illness, which I still take medication for, I could die like my mother did. So there's serious kinds of things that are at stake here if people are not getting what they need because the system screws up. Now, I think we all know that systems screw up. They're just not perfect. And you can come up with all the safeguards you want. There's going to be some point where it screws up. And when I heard the notion of computer technology, of course what comes to mind is that for every tech safeguard, there's some young techie who's going to figure out how to get around it. So, I mean, that's another issue. That's really the privacy issue, which I know you're concerned about, but let me stick with what I'm really most qualified to talk about, which is the pain itself. I don't want to take up too much of your time, so I guess I'll skip. I had another example. Besides the going through withdrawal and experiencing that myself. I said a lot of things, so let me just say three things in conclusion that I think are most important for you to remember from what I said today. Real people suffer without their medications. and some will even die. All systems screw up eventually. And better, let's reverse the phrase and do it correctly, better 10 drug abusers get away with drugs they don't need than one innocent, pain-ridden person do without them. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much. Questions? Michael, would you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. My name is Michael James Long. I got a Doctor of Pharmacy degree from the USC School of Pharmacy. I'm the recipient of the Oregon State Pharmacists Association 1995 Pharmacist of the Year Award, and I am past president of the Lane County Pharmaceutical Association. I am now retired. I thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak, Senator Morissette, Senator George, and Senator Berger. I'll keep this short and sweet. The program earlier was a hard act to follow, and evidently there's big money involved. My objections reside mainly on the fact that there's no probable cause to treat all Oregonians as potential drug-seeking abusers. When I was president of the Lane County Pharmaceutical Association, we had a phone tree, and we often got questions from physicians to check on a patient for medical reasons, and we could do that fairly fast, and it was fairly efficient. One of the things that bothers me about the classifications of drugs in general is that it can be fairly arbitrary depending on what the government wants to put in a certain schedule, and they have done so. I'm not convinced that the confidentiality is a non-issue. I think there's a lot of problems with identity theft, and I do feel that you should give the public an opportunity to comment on this bill if it gets out of committee. And that's about all I have to say. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, the process is that the time to comment is before the bill gets out of committee. We will have another, at least one, maybe two public hearings. There is a House side. They will go through the process as well. They will have several public hearings. So we want to give, and that's what Kathy Hahn from the Pain Commission, I was at that particular Pain Commission meeting, and there were objections by members who said we need to get the public to weigh in on this, so we want to do that. Unfortunately, our our time schedule is not as long as it normally is, and we only meet twice a week, and so we may have to even have an evening meeting at some point, but we do want to have adequate input on this bill. Now, Andrea Meyer from ACLU was, I know Andrea, she was good enough to say that she would be willing to hold over until next time, and Andrea is very articulate, and she, again, will, I think, present a good case against this bill. And the other thing is I have, because I was responsible for killing the bill last time, and I talked to leadership then, I talked to leadership again, and I said, I want the leadership involved. I want to give this a fair, thorough hearing before we, you know, pass this out and so on. If we do pass it out, but I want to give it a fair hearing. So the time to comment is early on, and there will be a second comment period on the House side if it does pass out and if it does go to the House. But I worked hard on this during the interim to patch up some of what I consider to be some problems, but there's always there's another side of the story, obviously, and that's what we want to hear. So thank you very much.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. And I'm really glad that Lane County is overrepresented here. I mean, you talk about Lane County and they're all here. Okay, thank you for your patience in being here, and we will have to adjourn We have another committee in 15 minutes, and we have to move and get set up for that, and you have to go home.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick comment.
Absolutely.
I think this is such an important issue. If you need us in the nighttime, we will be here. If you need us in the early morning, we will be on the weekend.
Okay, good. The last time we had a nighttime meeting was on the fluoride issue a couple of years ago. But we may do that. But we want to make sure that we do have adequate opportunity for people to testify. We have received a lot of I got your letter, your email. I did get that. And we do get lots of input from various people as well. And Dana, thank you so much for being here. You're going to be back in the state on the 19th of February. You're going to appear in Lane County. And it's a pharmacy, Lane County Pharmacy Board, and conference, right? Okay, and we will be talking about that, and so we're going to continue to get the word out. So, thank you very much. We are adjourned.